The following recording is offered by the Village Zendo. For more information, please visit villagezendo.org.
So, hello. Everyone. So, Ryotan-sensei yesterday mentioned our Zen mothers. And so I thought I'd begin with a memory I had of my own mother when I'd come home from school. There she'd be standing, ironing. The big pile of laundry, my father's shirts, my five brothers' shirts, my sister's blouses, my pajamas, pillow slips, big pile. And she would just go through this methodically, unselfconsciously, and this was week in, week out. Didn't complain, just did the task, did what was in front of her. And I remember one afternoon in particular, I must have been about 16 and had been reading all the feminist literature coming from the States. This is Ireland now in the late 60s. I was reading Kate Millett, Shalamith Firestone, who was it who wrote, not the second, well, The Second Sex, but then after, can't remember her, but she was a seminal writer. Anyway, analyzing the dynamics between the genders, the power dynamics, and explaining how, since housework was unpaid labor, wasn't factored into the GNP, therefore not valued, women had secondary status, and were exploited. And here's my mother. I saw her run our household expertly, you know, household of nine people, three meals a day, shopping, cooking, baking, making jam, running a vegetable patch, a fruit patch, all these skills that were unpaid. So I said, Mom, do you realize that you could be the CEO of a corporation? She looked at me, just pulled over the next shirt to iron. It wasn't until this week, at the start of our retreat, I found myself ironing altar cloths. And I thought of her. And I thought, selfless service. If she'd been a monk in a monastery, I wouldn't have questioned it. I couldn't see that that's what she was. It took 50 years of Zen practice. Why is it that we have such a hard time recognizing that our lives, just as we find them, in whatever era, are the manifestation of Buddha nature, are infused by the presence of God, are holy. When we began this retreat, Roshi talked about the need to return to silence. As a way to reconnect to that nature, to the source, as a way to remember who we are. She talked about this as an opportunity to heal. To heal what? To heal our separation from our true nature. And how did we separate? How did that happen? Well, I think trauma is not a bad place to start. And when we experience the holding that we've had this week, what it takes. The sitting in silence next to caring, thoughtful, beloved others. The exquisite attention and caring that's put into this container. The ordered and regular schedule and procedures where there's nothing unexpected, untoward, where we can finally come back, we feel safe enough to come back to our own hearts. To meet our hearts with just where they are and with what they are holding. And as Ryo said, that's what it takes. That's all it takes. That then we realize that we can bear what we have to bear. And we bear it by meeting it. And in meeting it, we discover that actually we have all the supports. They are instantly there. The gateless gate. To take us through and into the wholeness that we are. So I'm very grateful for for this opportunity. And, you know, the Buddha's intent was to cure suffering. And so we have the Dharma and we have the teachings. And again, as Ryo said, you know, there's Zen philosophy, Buddhist philosophy, and then there's our life, moment by moment. Yantu was asked, when arising and vanishing go on unceasingly, what then? Yantu growled, whose arising and vanishing is it? Yeah, we talk about impermanence and letting go of the self, but when you're in the doctor's office waiting to hear what their take on your situation, your conditions are, or you're sitting in Rikers with the guy who's shaking from whatever traumas he's been through. Or you're waking up to the realization that the friend that you've known for 25 years, you can never text again. So one of the things we do, because we're meaning-making people, is we latch on conceptually. To something that will make sense of the chaos. But Zen practice, as we're saying, is actually allowing ourselves, having the freedom, really, the freedom to experience it when we're not numb or dissociated. So in terms of meaning, was my mother a victim of Irish Catholic patriarchal oppression, or was she indeed a monk in a monastery engaged in a life of selfless service? Ma, where's my shirt? Is it ready yet? From a neuroscience perspective, we are all divided and discontinuous. This is Paul Bach speaking. I think it's Into the Silence. Okay, I should check that. It says the mental processes underlying our sense of self, feelings, thoughts, memories, are scattered through different parts, different zones of the brain. There is no special point of convergence, no cockpit of the soul, no soul pilot. They come together in a work of fiction. A human being is a storytelling machine. The self is a story Now, Buddhism wouldn't disagree. But neuroscience still has nothing to say about what the nature of consciousness is. Can't speak to what Yuka was addressing, the true man of no rank coming in and out of our six senses. Or the daily miracle that the Hanukkah candle, the Torah, was celebrating with us, what that's pointing to. Or the line, vast illuminating light pervading everywhere. Whenever this invocation is sent, it is subtly answered. So the self we know is both story and mystery. Who are you? Bodhidharma was asked. I don't know. Who are you? So this is the question. This is everything in Zen is reduced to this question, the question of our ultimate identity. Who are you? Do you know? And we're here to taste that, to taste it so fully that we don't forget. Because we do, don't we? We forget. We forget, why? Because our deluded thinking. Our deluded thinking or all our bodies that are programmed to fear. Our bodies that don't forget the messages that we inferred from our early treatment. How does Michael Jackson put it? I've been kicked around since I was born. I've been kicked around. It's okay, it's all right. The body doesn't forget. And we have these neuroreceptors, don't we, that just pick up the slightest tone of voice, a raise of an eyebrow, and we're into threat, primed to feel separate, alone, unsafe, agitated. And then go into our own personal narrative. Here it is again. I'm not wanted. I don't belong. I'm not loved. So we have some conditioning to overcome, and so Zen, the Zen stories that we tell are all ways to point help us. Look at this conditioning. And we're not sure whether these stories are actual events or whether they're just sort of made up teaching devices to, you know, to make a point. Like, for example, the example of Wike standing in the snow with his arm cut off, bleeding. It's very graphic. Do we actually think he cut his arm off, or is this just a poetic license, if you will, a literary way of impressing upon us how strong his determination was? So the koan I chose from the collection, case 33, happens to involve a woman who, like my own mother, had seven children. I mean, how could I not? And so before we go into this koan, I think a Jewish mother joke is in order. Why? Well, they're the most pithy, I think, in describing the human condition. So here are three Jewish mothers sitting on a park bench, and they're arguing about which of their sons are the most loving. First mother says, "My son sends me a bunch of flowers every week for Shabbos." The second mother says, "Well, my son calls me every day." And the third mother says, "My son is in therapy 5 days a week, and all he talks about is me." So it seems that this is the case in most cultures, is that mothers tend to invest their children with their own hopes, dreams for fulfillment. And so as we approach this koan then, we don't know much about this mother. Kind of doesn't really satisfy our storytelling need to understand her psychologically. So we have to understand it really in a metaphorical, intuitive sense, because this is a kind of a trigger warning. What this mother does, if she were to do it today, she'd end up in prison. So here goes. Yantu, the ferryman. So we have another ferryman. Yesterday we had one. And just a word about the ferryman, some of you may already know. He's typically a character who is described as ferrying people across to the other shore. When we understand that life, the sufferings of life and death, or samsara, are usually compared to crossing a river. And the teachings are a raft that help us get to the other shore. So, I mean, in this case, the reason why Yantu was a ferryman was that it was at the time when Wuzu, the emperor, had decided that Buddhism was a foreign religion and harmful to Chinese society. So he instigated a purge of all the monasteries. And as many as something like 260,000 monks and nuns were ordered back to lay life, essentially. Their monastery is destroyed, and the gold and the valuables taken, put into the coffers. So Yantu found himself without a job. He's now a ferryman. So when Yantu was in Chiatai, he was a ferryman on a lake in Aozhou. And on each side of the lake hung a board, and when someone wanted to cross, he or she would knock on the board. Yantu would call out, "Who is it?" Or, "Which side are you crossing to?" Then he would wave his oars, come out from the reeds, and go to meet the traveler. Well, one day, a woman carrying a child in her arms appeared and said, "I have nothing to ask you about plying the oar or handling the pole," she said, "but where did the child I'm holding in my arms come from?" So here it is again. Where are you from? What is this? What is this child? Where's this child from? And Yantu did, apparently, what Zen masters of the day did. They struck her with his oar. And the woman said, "I've given birth to 7 children. 6 of them didn't meet anyone who truly understood them. And this one will not be any good either." She then threw it into the water. It's kind of ouch. Yeah. So this is why we have to see it in metaphorical terms and see that the children are standing for the illusions. You know, the child is an extension of the self. We very much treasure our thoughts, our beliefs, just like our own children. They're products of our mind. And so when she asks, "Where is this from, this child from?" Could be, you know, "Where do my dreams and my illusions come from?" When the Zen master strikes her, she's in the moment. The meaning-making machine is stopped. So, I mean, I know we're talking about this 1,100 years later, and I actually think it's interesting. I've sat with this koan now for a while, well, a week, and I have to say, it still doesn't quite do it for me. And we know why, is that our consciousness is in a very, very, very different place than what may have worked for in 9th century psyche. To begin with, you know, they had no psychology to speak of. I think it's testimony we've still a long way to go. We're putting children in cages. We, you know, still don't have universal child care. We have a long way to go, but we can say we've traveled some in our understanding or in our relationship to other beings. We don't hit. Life may, as Rio said, hit us with an oar, but your teacher doesn't. We've refined our methods. So I was curious to see what Zen Master Miao Zhong, how she would relate to this story. She doesn't skip a beat. Here's what she writes. "A leaf of a boat drifts across the vast stretch of water, a leaf of a boat. So you can relate. This is the self, how fragile, how transient. A leaf of a boat drifts across a vast stretch of water, lifting and dancing his oars, he sings to a different tune. So, you know, the leaf, you can imagine, it's buffeted and tossed in the waves. And all the, you know, the conditions, the climate, the weather. The oarman is able to hear a different tune. His ears can hear beyond immediate conditions. So immediate conditions are here. And yet, there's something larger. Mountain clouds and ocean moon, both are tossed away. Mountain clouds we get. You know, the oof, things are not good here. Clouds, gray, threats, a storm is threatened. Ocean moon, well, you know, it could also be our hopes. If I'm enlightened, then maybe I could get along better with my partner. Or, you know, if I'm enlightened, then maybe I do get the job I want. My life somehow comes together. So we have these hopes and dreams, like the Jewish mom. The son, he loves me. He'll fill all the holes in my being. And the hope is that maybe enlightenment will do the same. Mountain clouds and ocean moon both are tossed away. So when everything is tossed away, what's left? The battle won, Zhuang Zhu's butterfly dream carries on. Zhuang Zhu, he was a Taoist writer who penned the famous story of the man who wakes up. He's had a dream that he's a butterfly, and then he wonders, well, maybe is he now a butterfly dreaming he's a man? Or is he a man who dreamt he was a butterfly? So there's the dream. And when we wake up, we know the dream. We know how we get caught, how we get entranced in our delusions. We've seen this day in and day out in Zazen. I'm not cut out for this. I'm no good. I'm not worthy. They all do it better than me. I'll never make it. And on and on and on. Dreams. Or the other dream is that this is who I am. That myself is my nose and my face and my body, which is like they say, you know, a rich man, a rich woman living in a palace and locked in a hovel and not knowing about all the rooms in the palace. So when we wake from the dream, does it make everything okay? No. It just makes everything sharper, more vivid, and more precious, because we know. A line from Master Zuki says, twisting and turning, settling the Buddha mind is hard. We can relate. So in terms of dropping our illusions, like this mother did peremptorily, letting go of our thoughts is hard. It's hard enough. But what's more difficult, I think, to see are the ingrained beliefs. We're not even aware of them until something happens, someone says something. And suddenly we're filled with anxiety. And up comes the meaning-making machine. Well, you see, you're just not up to scratch. You're not competent. And the next step is you're not competent, then you're not lovable. You're not lovable, then your mother will drop you in the lake. You'll be gotten rid of. So these are the terrors that are still, those infantile terrors when she doesn't come. I'm going to be abandoned. That surge up still, even though we are adults in the world, accomplished. These fears, primitive, primal fears still play, and the slightest thing can set them off, and we're off to the races. And they're, you know, they're fear-based. Our body, as I said, is hardwired to pick up on danger, and so that's what we do. That's what we notice. We notice the one thing that's wrong. We don't notice all the beautiful things, the miracles that are happening. It's like the comedian, right? The whole room is laughing at his jokes except for one little wizened woman up front, and that's all he sees. She won't smile. She won't crack a smile. So we've had this amazing week of being, we had front row seats at the stories that we tell on ourselves, about ourselves. And all we can do is just be very loving and very tender. Because we know, as we say, they're coming from a very young place, very young. And so we have to be tender. This is what we've learned in 1,100 years. That our compassion takes a different form, doesn't it? And that's, you know, thanks to the help of neurobiology and psychology and all of the various tools that we've learned to understand the complexity of what human is. And this is a very, very challenging time, isn't it, for humanity, for this next leap in consciousness that we are coming to the realization again that so much of the structures and the institutions and our ways of being are unsustainable and they no longer serve And we have some of us who are very nostalgic for the way things were. Which is understandable. And some of us who are anxiously waiting the birth of new forms, new ways of taking care of our planet, new ways of being inclusive, new ways of ensuring greater equality and power sharing, new ways of meeting the needs of all and not just the few. But in order for this birthing to happen, we need to let go of what doesn't serve us individually and collectively. The stories that don't measure up, that are not accurate. To let go of the mindset that separates us from each other, that doesn't see that who we are is an integral part of the whole. We wouldn't be here otherwise. And that each molecule in the universe is a reflection of every other molecule and is influenced by and influencing. This is our world. This is who we are. This is what we are. This is what we've signed on for. It is us, all of us. And one thing that's needed for birthing, we know, is to be able to breathe deeply. So that's one thing, our practice, how our practice serves. But the other way is to let go of the deluded thinking that keeps us small, locked into this trance of unworthiness. The voices that tell us we're alone, that we're broken, that we don't matter, that we are unloved, that we're not good enough, that we don't rank, or that we're the one with the right way to do things. We know. You don't know, we know. Along those lines, Ram Dass, who died this month, he was a treasured guru for my generation. He gave a talk about 50 years ago during the 60s, which were also tumultuous, that kind of seems to apply to our polarized times. And something we might consider as we think going forward how we're going to contribute. And he said, I know many of you will feel uncomfortable when I say this, but the hippies create the police as much as the police create the hippies, he said. The liberals create the conservatives. The protesters create the John Birchers just as much as the John Birchers create the protesters. I guess the John Birchers, I forget, I guess there must have been some right-wing, So as long as you are attached to whatever pole you are representing, the vibrations which you are sending out are creating its polar opposite around you. If you can do whatever is your karma, which may be walking in a protest march or fighting in Vietnam or being a conservative or a liberal or a housewife or being a yogi. If you can do it without attachment and do it fully and thoroughly, but without attachment, then you do not create that karma. You do not create the polar opposite. So it's kind of a koan for us to face into. Tonight we will, after Fusatsu with Miyoko Sensei, we will have an opportunity to make a vow. And so your vow can be, you might want to consider what it is, what voice you think it's time to no longer listen to, what voice in your head. Just choose one. So that you can say to it next time it comes, I may say, no, thank you for sharing. We don't listen to that anymore. Or, I'm sorry, your shelf life has expired. So, lots of ironing to do.